You are listening to episode one of the Swallow Your Pride podcast, and today's guest is Ed Bice, and he is probably one of the most knowledgeable people as far as knowing the research and the evidence base behind so many treatment strategies in dysphagia. He's remarkable. He's so impressive with his knowledge base, and I just wanted to get him on here right away, help to dispel some myths and help to just put some good, important information and research out there to you guys. Welcome to the Swallow Your Pride podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Richard. I'm a board-certified specialist in swallowing and swallowing disorders, and I know firsthand how much confusing and conflicting information there is out there about how we assess and treat swallowing disorders. This podcast is all about bringing everyone together, getting on the same page, being open to new ideas, and using evidence-based treatment strategies for our patients with dysphagia. So let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll get right into the podcast in just a minute, but you know, the whole point of doing this podcast is to be able to bring you some extremely valuable information that doesn't cost you a darn thing that you can just mindlessly listen to on your commute or while you're at the gym or making dinner. But some of you also might realize that you do want more information and you would like to get to use for it. So I've partnered with MedBridge for the entire month of September to bring you an amazing deal on their membership CEU packages. So I know it's getting towards the end of the year. You're like, oh crap, I need to catch up. I need to get some CEUs. We've got you covered. So I know there's a few different membership sites out there. Why did I decide to partner with MedBridge? No brainer. They have so many great resources all in one spot. There's webinars and lectures from Dr. Yanessa Humbert, Dr. Kate Hutchison, Dr. Katrina Steele, Dr. Marty Brodsky, Dr. Stephanie Daniels, Dr. Crary, Dr. Carnaby, Dr. Grower, Dr. Arvidsson on pediatric feeding and swallowing. So many awesome rock stars in our field. So whether you just need to brush up on the basics of swallowing physiology, or you want to learn more about dysphagia in acute care or stroke, or more about video fluoroscopy or rehabilitation treatment techniques, I could go on. You get the point. But you have access to all of these with a MedBridge membership. So the regular price for this membership is $320, but MedBridge has sweetened the deal for Swallow Your Pride listeners for the month of September, and they are upgrading everyone to their premium membership, which includes patient handouts and videos, a mobile app, live webinars, and more. So all of that for $95. So unlimited access to hundreds of CEUs for $95. So go to medbridgeeducation.com, click on speech language pathology, sign up for the SLP education plan, and enter promo code SYP at checkout. So SYP for Swallow Your Pride, enter promo code SYP, and you'll be automatically upgraded to that premium membership, but only for the price of $95. So super steal, get on that. Now we'll get on with the show. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing really well. I'm in beautiful Ohio. How could I ask for more?
How could you? I was in Ohio yesterday. What part are you in?
I am in Dayton this evening.
Oh, fun. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to come on and chat with me.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right. I mean, you're probably one of my most favorite people in dysphagia land just because of your, you know, kind of no bullshit approach to research and swallowing and dysphagia. And, you know, I mean, we've thrown a million magic tricks at the wall to see what would stick, but ultimately the, you know, research and the literature is really what we should be using.
Absolutely. And it's so nice to hear at least I have one fan, right?
You do. Yes. You do. All right. So I guess, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself where you've kind of got a long history. You've done quite a few gigs.
Yeah. I guess when you've been around a long time, you have lots of opportunities. So I have done just about everything in the vein that a speech pathologist can do. I worked in the public schools the first 10 years of my career. And then left there knowing that I wanted to work with adults in a medical setting. So I knew that I didn't have the wherewithal to do that. So I went to work at a nonprofit speech and hearing center with 12 other SLPs so that I could learn from them and have them mentor me to become a, you know, an adult medical speech pathologist. So after that, then I went into skilled nursing and started out as a staff level person, moved into director of rehab. And then in that world, I did everything from being a staff member, director of rehab, to regional manager, COO of a therapy company, vice president of clinical services, owned my own compliance company, did all those kind of things. And currently now I am a clinical educator for a company that distributes an SCMG biofeedback device.
Awesome. Yeah, that is lots of stuff. So, you know, when you kind of, I guess, throw your opinion around on social media, people might want to actually listen because it's not just from, you know, you've kind of been around, you've had a lot of experiences, a lot of opportunities, as you would say. So I think that's why I really respect what you have to say a lot of times.
Well, thank you. And again, I always just say that, you know, I'm not smarter than anyone else. I've just had more opportunities. And so, and I've seized those opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Well, tonight we're going to talk about something, you know, it was kind of funny. I don't even remember where this all started at. I don't know, maybe you remember, but I wrote something. I will admit I was wrong about this. I'm totally fine admitting that. I know we don't, none of us know everything. You know, we're all on our own little dysphagia islands and we know what we know. And, you know, the only disservice you do to yourself is when you don't reach out and try to learn more and learn from your peers. And so, you know, Ed was gracious enough to tell me that I was wrong in this and, you know, sent me some research articles. And what it was talking about fatigue of the swallow and fatigue of the tongue when we're swallowing. And I think a lot of speech pathologists have gotten in this habit, you know, of working in, you know, skilled nursing mostly. And one of the goals or one of the objectives is to downgrade them to a puree diet due to fatigue. And I don't even remember what I said, Ed. Do you remember what I said?
It was in one of your blogs, and it was just one of the points that you were making about, you know, what if your patient fatigues? And so, you know, I try not to, particularly people I respect, I don't challenge them in an open forum. So I private messaged you and said, hey, let's talk about this. And so we exchanged some emails back and forth with some articles and just kind of started a dialogue about fatigue and what is fatigue and does it really exist and in swallowing and how would we measure it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you totally just blew my mind right open. I mean, I'm not afraid to admit that I was just like, what the heck? You know, I mean, I like to think that I'm pretty immersed in the literature and I know kind of a lot what's going on, but I was like, what the heck? I missed all this, but yeah, that's no excuse. So here we are. So Ed is here to fill us in about how really the swallow does not fatigue. So I'll let you kind of blab for a little bit, Ed.
Sure. Or at least it doesn't fatigue in the way that we traditionally talk about it, right? You know, we talk about all these meaningless terms like they have some kind of actual meaning. Oh, my patient started coughing in the middle of the meal, so they're fatiguing. Well, you know, how are you measuring that? How are you measuring fatigue? And I think that, like we've discussed before and has been in lots of forums, you know, treating dysphagia is such an emotional experience that therapists approach it with fear and intrepidation rather than with science. And so we make these leaps and judgment about, oh, well, because they're coughing more, they're fatiguing. Well, that's not what the literature would teach us. It, you know, we sit and we watch people eat and we count their coughs, right? Isn't that how you do therapy?
No.
It's not? Oh, really?
No. Okay. God.
because I always say, you know, we as SLPs have this magic aura that when we sit with people and watch them eat, they just get better.
They do. They do so much better with us just sitting next to them. We exude this magical, I think that someone said you have magical swallowing fairy dust or something that you sprinkle on your patients.
Yeah, that's what somebody said to me when I said I'd never had a patient refuse an instrumental study, or I've never been given a patient in 20 plus years that didn't participate in the study. Yeah, so they said I had magical dust. And it was like, it's called tenacity, right? That's what it's called.
Yeah. Bottle that up and sell it real quick.
So anyway, so then, you know, so let's start with what is fatigue? You know, we talk about fatigue like we know something about it. Well, what is it? Well, the classical definition is that fatigue is the failure to maintain the required or expected force in an activity. So before we can say, is our patient fatiguing, we have to answer a couple of questions, like, was there sufficient force when the task began? Or how much force is needed to perform this activity? Was it measured before the activity started? Was it measured before the F word was documented? And what impact does fatigue actually have on swallowing, right? I mean, those are some pretty important questions to ask yourself before you start throwing the F word around in your documentation. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, 100%.
So, of course, then if you're going to fatigue, first, the first thing is the force. That's fatiguing. So let's talk about force. So if you're going to measure strength or force, you have to do it in an objective, reliable way. And we know, but that the first thing that people are going to say when they listen to this podcast is, but I don't have an instrument to do that, right? Well,
right.
Then don't document it.
If
you don't have something to measure with, then don't pretend that you measured something. My classic example is you can't stand on a yardstick and tell someone how much they weigh.
It's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. So if you don't have the right tool, you can't make the statement. So before entertaining the possibility that an individual's swallowing is affected by weakness, it's important to determine if something is actually weak. And we know that the current standard of care in clinical swallowing evals is to have the patient push their tongue against a tongue depressor to determine strength, because we all have this magical power that knows how much they should push against the tongue depressor, right? Well, there's a problem with that. And Heather Clark published a study in 2003 where she used the IOP as a measurement and then had both experienced and inexperienced clinicians, students actually, measure using a tongue depressor to see how good we are at determining how much pressure a tongue is exerting. And overall, there was a weak to moderate correlation between the therapist's clinical judgment and the IOP measurements. And I love this one. And you, I know that you're a big fan of this one. Well, I've been doing this for 30 years, and that's how I know. Because somehow, at 20 years, somehow you get X-ray vision and you get all these gifts from the heavens that come and are bestowed upon you.
No, I was talking to a friend the other day about this, and like, you know, I live in Buffalo and we have Roswell Park Cancer Center here. And so like constantly on the news, they talk about, oh, there's this new cancer treatment. So we're going to try this with this new, you know, cohort. And it's like, oh my gosh, they're constantly trying new things. And then we have speech pathologists in dysphagia that still want to do what we've been doing 30 years ago, even though we've got plenty of research telling us no. You know, like imagine if these cancer doctors just decided to stick with what they knew from 30 years ago. Like, where would we be? Where the heck would we be?
Right. People would be dying left, right, and center, right? Still from cancer. Or I think about AIDS research, and because that's been in my lifetime, right? And it used to be a death sentence if you developed AIDS. You know, there was no chance that you were going to make it out. And if we hadn't pushed and researched and changed our regimen or medication regimen, we would still be in that situation. And that's something that's happened, you know, in the very recent past.
Yeah.
And if you're operating on information from even 15 years ago, you're missing probably half of the research that's been poured into this disorder.
Right.
So anyway, in this interesting study, the students were actually better than the experienced clinician at matching the rating to the IOP.
That's wild.
Isn't it? So, you know, experience does not equal better. And we all need to recognize that. You know, I've been doing this a long time, and I'm always willing to be open to hearing what someone else has to say and reading new research. And I still get really excited about it. You know, I get like, yay, I'm happy to learn something new. And And I often lay awake at night thinking about patients in the past that if I had known this, I could have helped them.
Right, right. I think that's the kicker.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I always like to say, be willing to give up good for better.
Well, you know the name of this podcast, Ed?
I don't think so.
It's called Swallow Your Pride.
There you go. There you go. Yes. I love it. I love it. Yeah. It's perfect because we all have to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Just admit that things we learned 10, 15 years ago are not what we know now. So,
right, right. And that's okay. It's not, we weren't bad people. We just didn't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe we were bad people and we didn't know.
Who knows?
I can't speak for everyone.
Right.
So now we know that using a tongue depressor, that we're really poor at making assessments about tongue strength or ability using a tongue depressor, right? And that I will tell you, the students were almost twice as accurate as the experienced clinician. It is crazy. So the second issue is, are we measuring the right thing? So there's a study by Bouchard that was published in 2000 that said when people were doing tongue protrusion tests, that the greatest amount of pressure was still almost an inch behind the incisors. So when the tongue was stuck out, the greatest amount of pressure was happening back still in the mouth.
Huh.
So again, what are we doing by measuring, you know, tongue strength? Because how strong does your tongue have to be when it's stuck out?
Right. Because I'm not really chewing with my tongue out.
Yeah. You wouldn't have much of a tongue left if you tried that, would you?
Right.
So then another important aspect of all of this, that there have been many studies done on this particular topic, is the position of the jaw impacting how much pressure the tongue can generate or how much strength you're measuring. So Solomon 2004 indicated that bite blocks that separated the jaw by more than 2 millimeters had a negative effect on the measurement of tongue strength. So imagine how much the jaw is, you know, how much jaw excursion people are having when you say stick out your tongue and push against this stick.
Right.
So if 2 millimeters makes a difference, imagine how much the difference is that your jaw is hanging wide open.
Right.
You know, and nobody even thinks about that. Where, you know, these are things that we're just not thinking about.
Right.
And we need to be thinking about. So, all right. So we've talked about strength and how we, you know, how we really aren't good at measuring it without an instrument. So let's consider endurance, because fatigue would be the lack of endurance. So endurance is the prescribed amount of work an activity can be performed either by repetition or sustained activity. And of course, in swallowing, it would be more repetition than sustained activity. Unless you disagree, then we could talk about that.
I do not disagree, Ed.
Okay, good. So I, you know, when I'm teaching a course, I generally laugh and say, you can disagree and be wrong if you want. That's your prerogative.
Right, right. I don't want to fall victim to that tonight.
So often when we can't explain a change in function, we just write it off to fatigue. But if you don't have baseline information, now we're making two leaps. First, we're saying the tongue is or isn't strong enough to do something. And then we're saying that somewhere in the middle of the activity, it's fatiguing. So now we've created two fairy tales. I mean, how many glass slippers do you have in your practice? I don't know. Anyway, so, you know, the patient may experience an increased sense of effort, and that can be attributed to an awareness within the central nervous system that the neuro drive has increased to accomplish the same amount of work. However, if baseline strength is reduced, endurance trials will be lower from the very beginning, right? I mean, if you don't have the strength from the very beginning, then you're already screwed.
Right.
And there's studies about that. There was one that came out of Katrina Steele's lab, one of her PhD students, Ashwini, published, where she went into skilled nursing facilities in Canada and looked at people who were taking excessive amounts of time during meals. So, you know, an 85-year-old lady who was taking an hour to eat, and she looked at her 85-year-old healthy peer who was taking 20 minutes to eat, and, you know, looked at various parameters and said, what's the difference between these two people? And the difference was their beginning tongue pressures, which, yeah, quite telling, right? So it wasn't fatigue in the middle of the meal. They started out at a disadvantage. Huh. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. So if you don't know what you're starting with, how can you know what you're ending with?
Right.
All right. So now let's really talk about the tongue. So most of the tongue consists of fatigue-resistant muscle fibers type 1 and type 2A, with a smaller portion being type 2B, which are very susceptible to fatigue.
So, sorry, let's back up, Ed. So type 1 muscle fibers versus type 2A. So type 2A is like the sprinter's muscles, right?
Okay, so they are the sprinter muscles, but they're distinguished from type 2B in that type 2B are quite easily fatigued and type 2A are not. So generally we just talk about type 1 and type 2, but type 2 is actually broken down into two groups. And type B are is the group that seems to be more susceptible to fatigue. And it's, you know, we can talk about muscles and muscle fibers all day because they're extremely fascinating. You know, type 1, which we call the marathon runners because they just keep going and going like the Energizer Bunny, we call them aerobic muscles because they are fed by the oxygen in your blood. Okay, so you know, you have an endless supply in theory of oxygen in your blood. You can breathe in, you create more oxygen, it's transported throughout your body. Type 2 are more anaerobic kinds of muscles. So they are fed more by the nutrients that are in your blood. Well, and we know that as we age, that our metabolism and nutritive levels in our body are different. We're not metabolizing in the same way. So sarcopenia, or muscle wasting with age, destroys those type 2 muscles faster than it destroys the type 1 muscles. So in the end, we're kind of losing type 2 at a much faster rate than we're losing type 1, which is a good thing because the type 1s have more endurance, so they can help us get the job done.
Yeah. Just wanted to throw that little muscle lesson in there for
there you go. That some we people that, we won't charge any yeah. extra for that.
Yeah. No, Dunhouse.
but knowing this and understanding muscles and how muscles work and what the impact with aging is, particularly since most of the patients that we work with in dysphagia are, we would consider geriatric, not all of them, right? I mean, in our,
right.
I don't work with peds. Do you work with peds?
I do not. Nope.
You know, we may get the occasional stroke at a younger age, but most of the people or some kind of neuromuscular disease, MS or something at a younger age, but most of the people that we work with are geriatrics. And so understanding the aging process and what it does to the system is pretty darn important to what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
The face, like the orbicularis oris and buccinators, are also, type 1 and type 2A more than they are type 2B. So by very nature, they're pretty resistant to fatigue. And that makes a lot of sense when you start thinking about, you know, whatever you believe or however you think we got here through evolution or creation or whatever, that whether it be either one of those, that we had to be created so that this system, this swallowing system, would not break down very easily because it's required to sustain life, right? I mean, you can cut off my leg and I can live.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a sick joke, you know, the frog joke where it's the scientist cut off one leg and said, you know, I told the frog to jump and it jumped. And when it got to the fourth leg, he cut it off. And his conclusion was, cut off four legs and the frog becomes deaf because it no longer follows the command to jump. But it's kind of the conclusions we come to, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of how we think too.
Well, I mean, that's like the people that just slap an NPO diagnosis on people.
Right,
you know, it's like, oh my God, you cough once, you're NPO.
Yep.
Like, that's it.
Yeah. Can't, you're not going to bait me with that one.
No, I won't bait you. All right. Back on task here, Ed.
So, you know, again, so we don't have to have an arm or a leg or whatever, but in the absence of a feeding tube, if you can't swallow, you can't live. So this system has to have evolved or been created or whatever to be resistant to fatigue and to maintain its integrity. So, you know, I'm not going to say that it's impossible to fatigue the tongue, but it requires excessive strenuous exercises, not normal activity. So I would not consider a meal excessive strenuous activity. That's something that we just do.
What about like making like 20 duck faces?
Yeah, probably not.
Okay.
Probably not. But I, well, okay. I mean, is that a therapy technique or whatever? I don't know.
Yeah. It's part of oral motor exercises that a lot of people do. Just make 20 duck faces. And
what is that doing? Yeah. What's that doing?
But you tell me, Ed. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Working on our orbicularosaurus muscle.
Okay. We want to be Donald Duck or something. I don't know.
That's
never a goal that I've written for a patient, to be able to protrude your lips like Donald Duck. I don't get it.
I'm not going to call anybody out right now, but there's like some serious like dysphagia workbooks that's in.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, because now I'm really off task, because you know that strengthening a muscle.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. That strengthening a muscle, because you know how divergent I am. I'm very happy to talk about whatever you want to talk about, but strengthening a muscle requires overload. Right. And how much overload is a natural range of motion activity creating? So, you know, I can stick out my lips like Donald Duck. Right. I mean, I can do that when I'm talking to my dogs. I do that. Or when my kids were little, you know, you're making screwy faces and talking to your kids. How is that creating overload in the system?
Well, I think that's the money quote right there. I think a lot of people, for some reason or another, you know, whether they didn't have a medical background or they didn't have a science background, it's kind of like when you talk about you have to overload the muscle, it's like you just see people's heads explode, you know.
Yeah, but
I know we're kind of going back to like a physiology 101 lesson here, but you have to understand these underlying kinematics in order to know what we're treating.
Right. And, you know, they would never go to the gym and not put a weight in their arms and saying, look, I'm doing bicep curls.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you say that to someone, they would think you were insane. But then we ask patients to do things with no overload and you call them exercise. No, that's just movement. That's not exercise. That's just moving.
So they're called oral motor movements.
That's what we need to call them. OMM.
Yeah. All right. We're going to start a rebellion.
There you go. So from now on, when someone mentions it, now we're going to say, are you meaning exercises or movements?
Right.
So let's talk about what you're really saying here.
Right.
You've just started this whole new problem.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Back on task, Ed.
This extraneous, and this is from a Nancy Solomon 2006 study where she made that quote. That was not something that Ed made up, that the tongue requires excessive strenuous exercise, not normal activity to fatigue. And the very interesting thing is, if the tongue is fatigued, articulation will deteriorate as well. So if you really want to know if your patient's tongue is fatiguing, do some articulation tasks before they start eating. And when you start thinking that something is going awry, have them do this, you know, read the grandfather passage or something and see if their articulation has deteriorated. That would be a really, you know, maybe something that you could do. I don't know why. But anyway, if you want to do it, maybe that's something you could do. But the other interesting thing is that in a short time, it returns to near normal baseline strength. Okay. Even when like you fatigue the heck out of it and then, you know, their articulation, your tongue is just laying in the bottom of your mouth like a piece of meat because it's so tired and you can't do anything. In a very short time, it rebounds and is back to be able, you know, able to do what it wanted to do in the first place or needed to do in the first place. And in that particular 2006 study, in her whole cohort, the average time was 15 minutes, but a lot of people took less than 15 minutes. So, you know, so it's like you take somebody's tongue and you tie a string to it and slam the door 50 times. Maybe that would be enough to fatigue it. But then in 15 minutes, you could do the whole thing over again. So what does this say about swallowing? Well, first of all, there's something called functional reserve, right, when we swallow. So I know Tara Hart, who is the owner or the CEO of IOP, her dad invented the device. So yeah. we keep in contact a lot. And of course, our friend Vince has the record for the greatest tongue pressure ever using that.
The lingual legend.
That's right. That's right. 118 kilopascals, right?
Unreal. Unreal.
I know. Yeah, it is. So I say he could lick the paint off the wall.
Oh my God, he probably could. Oh my God.
So anyway, you know, we don't need that much tongue pressure to be able to swallow. Normal range is somewhere around 40 kilopascals, right? But then
that's
even
exactly what mine was.
Well, see, then you're right where you need to be. And I remember
I'm perfect. If you didn't know, I'm perfect.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But I remember the first time I played with an IOP was, you know, because we do swallow exercises all the time, right? Every time you tell someone to do something, you do it with them. And so, you know, no way in hell is my tongue pressure average, right? It's got to be way above average.
Right.
And so I used to IOP and it was just like 44 or 45. So I'm real close to where you were. And I was like, there is no way my tongue is only 45.
Right. I mean, years of doing these exercises.
That's right. So I played with it like for 30 minutes, just pressing and pressing and pressing. And the next day, my submental muscles were so sore. It hurt to swallow.
That's funny.
Yeah. Anyway. Where were we? So we're talking about functional reserve. So, you know, the average person, like we said, is somewhere around 40. But when you swallow a bolus, you're not using 40 kilopascals of pressure, somewhere in the 20s usually. So that difference between that 20-something number and the 40 number is called your functional reserve. And so we have friends who have like tons of functional reserve, like they could pass it out to other people.
Right.
The example would be, if you can curl 100 pounds, but lifting a bottle would be very simple to you because you have a lot of functional reserve. And the same is true of the tongue. You don't need all the pressure that you have to swallow a bolus. So again, if you start out with a 40 kilopascals, you can go a long time before you get below the level that you need to swallow that bolus that's in your mouth. And you would have to go below that level for it to be considered fatigue. But we don't know. Again, I'm going to say that's 100 times while we talk. You wouldn't know any of this if you don't have the right instrument to measure it.
Right.
You know, and the right instrument, there are several of them. You know, the cheapest one, and I'm not plugging. Well, maybe I am plugging someone. Maybe it is. You know, the cheapest one that we could find is the IOP at this point in time. That gives us nice clinical data about this. But, you know, if Nissa Humbert happens to tune in, but we do also have to realize that strength is only one component of what the tongue has to do when we swallow, right? It has a three-dimensional movement. It's not just pressure. We have, you know, your tongue, lateral sides of your tongue have to come up and meet your teeth or your gums, whatever you happen to have. The tongue tip has to be on the alveolar ridge. The back of the tongue has to be against the soft palate. And then you have to have this nice wave motion of anterior to posterior movement to get everything back. So strength is not the only thing we need to be worried about related to the tongue. So that's just kind of another commercial for thinking about maybe the motor plan is getting disrupted, right? Who knows?
Yeah.
At the end of all of this, the dilemma remains that we lack the evidence and ability to explain and document the persistent use or idea of fatigue when it comes to dysphagia. But there are a couple of studies that we want to talk about. So I've been talking mostly about the studies that Nancy Solomon has published in what we've talked about so far. But we come forward to about 2010, and there was a very interesting study, and maybe this is where a lot of the confusion comes from, that was published by Kays et al. Joanne Robbins was involved in this study, so several people were involved. And they looked at 22 healthy adults divided into two age groups, younger adults and older adults. And they took two measurements using the IOP. They did just the maximum tests, right? So how much can you push? And then they did an endurance test. How long can you sustain this pressure at 50% of whatever your maximum was for however long? So that would be your endurance. And they measured it twice before the meal took place. And then they had the participants eat a meal of a bagel with peanut butter, carrot sticks, and eight ounces of chocolate milk.
Got it.
Okay. Now, I will say, yeah, so they did this twice. They measured the endurance and they measured the maximum effort and the endurance twice. And they gave the patient, I believe it was a 30-minute rest break in between those measurements. But after the second time, they gave them no break before they ate this meal of a bagel and peanut butter, carrot sticks, and 8 ounces of chocolate milk. Now, I don't know about you, but eating a bagel with peanut butter is a daunting task for me.
Yes. It doesn't even taste good anymore.
Right. I mean, you know, you look at it, you think it's even worth the effort.
Yeah. Right. I can just drink some wine and get the same amount of calories.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And it probably it does taste better, you know, and then carrot sticks. Yeah. I mean, come on, think about the amount of chewing that went into this activity. Not even thinking about the tongue, just thinking about the chewing. Anyway, so all the subjects showed reduced strength and endurance post-meal, okay? So the young adults showed greater decrease in the anterior tongue than the older adults. Wonder why. So it goes back to something, the hypothesis is, it goes back to something that we talked about already, and that is that as you age, the type 2 cells are dying off, and so you have more type 1 cells, and so as you get older, you end up with more type 1, which are greater endurance, and when we're younger, there's more type 2 cells in the anterior tongue, but as we age, maybe there's more type 1. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that would lead to increased endurance in the front of the tongue. So, you know, there's lots of very interesting things going on in this study.
Chocolate milk have any significance?
Well, you know, I don't know. I have a thing about chocolate anyway. I think that. You know, no, I mean, when it comes to my patients and when I come to thinking about how we consume things. So, you know, when you eat something chocolate, one of my classic examples of that swallowing is not like there's a voluntary phase and an involuntary phase. It's a continuum.
Right.
Because we all eat certain things the same way, like a Dove chocolate. You know, when you give someone a Dove chocolate, they pop it in their mouth and they put it in the middle of their tongue. They push their tongue to their hard palate and they suck. Well, if it's voluntary, then why do we do it the same way? Because there's something about this sweet, melty texture that makes us want to savor it.
Right.
And so if you have a patient with a swallow delay, why the heck would you be giving them something chocolate as a stimulus?
I don't know. I think when I was pregnant, I just needed chocolate so bad, I just chewed it so fast. So, that might be the only caveat here.
Right. Well, but the thing of it is, you can take voluntary control of this process.
Right.
You know, just like walking is controlled by a central pattern generator as well. And we don't normally think about walking. But when we go out on ice, all of a sudden we take volitional control of our gait pattern. And what happens to it? It's not as efficient. It's not as fluid. It breaks down. And we can take volitional control of how we eat our Dove chocolate, right?
Yep.
But if we're not, then we generally all eat it the same way.
Yep.
And so again, if you want to speed up a swallow, a patient who has a swallow delay, and you want to work on skill training or motor learning or whatever is causing the problem. You know, you don't want to start with something that causes the problem.
Right.
You want to start with something that doesn't cause the problem to minimize the delay. So that's why I don't usually engage chocolate, particularly in the beginning, or recommend that people engage in chocolate in the beginning stages of therapy. Wait until later when you really want to challenge the system because you've established some new plan or, you know, anyway. And you want to make sure that it's going to carry over to things that would impact it negatively. And we can talk about that later. But we did this contrived meal that we know anyone would have a problem consuming. And we did it right after we had them do this endurance task with the IOP. Yeah. And remember the whole thing about the tongue and that 2 millimeter excursion that Solomon did? Well, how much excursion do you have with your jaw to chew a bagel? More than 2 millimeters, I can guarantee you.
Yep.
So anyway, and then they tested them right at the end of the meal with no rest period. So now they've had this task of endurance, and then they've had the task of eating, and now we're going to measure it. Well, very interesting. What she said then was that 2 of the people showed signs of dysphagia after they consumed this meal. And the signs of dysphagia that she said were throat clearing, coughing. Well, think about what that might be after you eat peanut butter and have had some time. Yeah, I mean, is that a sign of dysphagia? Well, it could have been dysphagia if you're thinking about esophageal dysphagia.
Yeah.
But was it oral pharyngeal dysphagia? Well, here we are taking another big leap, right?
Right.
And they didn't test that. They didn't look at that. They just started making assumptions.
Right.
And that is always bothersome when you're doing research and you start, you know, getting out your x-ray glasses and pretending that you know something that you don't know. But if you don't read this piece of literature critically,
right,
then you're going to say, oh, the tongue fatigues when you eat a meal.
Right.
And it causes, you know, and that's, and people cough more.
Right. Yeah. There we go. Dysphagia in a nutshell.
There you go. So there's another paper written by Ravenhorst Bell that was published in 2012. And she looked at all older adults. And what she did was she measured the same way that was measured in the previous case study. But then she let them just eat a regular meal that was served at their facility. So she didn't contrive anything. She didn't control anything. She just let them eat what was served on their tray that day. Of course, they were all eating the same thing. And one of the faults of this study is she didn't say how much of that meal they consumed. So did everyone she tests eat 100% of that meal? We don't know. But the interesting thing was that after the meal, everyone's tongue pressures were actually improved.
That's hilarious.
To statistical significance. So is that saying once the system is engaged and working, that it becomes better?
That's what it sounds like to me.
In this study, nobody like cleared their throat or coughed, or at least she doesn't talk about it. Yeah. If they did. and so, you know, so we start making this assumption that it's fatigue because they're coughing or because they're throat clearing at the end of the meal, when that very well could be a reflux or some kind of esophageal motility problem. Heavens, you got a bagel now stuck in your esophagus, right? With peanut butter on it. I mean, yes. You know.
Yes. Yeah. I've got Globus sensation the rest of the day just thinking about it.
That's exactly right. And you want to stimulate that vagus nerve in your esophagus. I don't know what would do it more than that, unless you like swallowed an apple whole or something, right?
Yes. Yeah. Carrot sticks. Yeah.
So anyway, it just becomes comical when you read this with a critical eye, right?
Yeah.
So there we have a dilemma, right? That we have these 2 studies, and one of them says your tongue gets weaker, one of them says that it gets stronger. Well, when you only have 2 studies and they conflict each other, you have something called equipoise, which means they cancel each other out because they're equal, right?
Right.
Well, fortunately, we have all this work by Nancy Solomon that I quoted earlier, where she's telling us that the tongue doesn't fatigue in all of her studies on strength and endurance measuring the tongue. So haha, we win. We have more than one study saying that it doesn't fatigue or that it even might get better eating a meal. So where is the evidence that it fatigues?
Right.
You know, that's where we are. And so for us to walk around talking about fatigue like it's happening in the oral motor musculature is something that we just can't talk about or that we just don't know and shouldn't talk about, because fatigue could be happening in lots of other systems that would impact what we're seeing with swallowing. People stop eating for lots of reasons, emotional demand, cognitive demand, respiratory demand, right? We know this
right.
A lot from the work, particularly of people like Marty Brodsky and Bonnie Martin Harris that, you know, have done a lot of work on how the respiratory system and swallowing system kind of coexist, that there are actually neurons that share the responsibility between the two activities. Or that one neuron works on both, I should have said. So, yeah, so it could be that this pause that's called in their work, particularly Dr. Brodsky and Dr. Martin Harris, they don't call it apnea because apnea has a negative connotation, right? It's just a pause or that happens when we swallow, a respiratory pause. That puts a demand on the respiratory system. And if you have some kind of chronic respiratory problem like COPD, then I mean, you're going to have a problem before you finish a meal, but it's not fatigue in the oral motor musculature. Right. So again, here we go making leaps and bounds and jumps and we're saying things that we don't know. And you know, the shameless plug is I'm getting ready to teach a webinar on COPD and dysphagia. Yeah. So yeah. I'm excited about that. I just have read like 30 articles about it. So it's all really like right here in front of my mind.
You nerd.
It's true.
It is.
Yeah. Anyway, like I was saying all these fun things I was learning about this and my kids were like, so you've been doing this all the time and you still don't know this stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I will not know it when I die. I will not know.
Right,
it.
Right. What kind of dummy still, are you?
That's right. I will still be learning. Hopefully.
Right. Well, that was great. Ed, that was a great, I mean, that was a great summary of just physiology of the body in general. I mean, which a lot of times we kind of just got to get out of our own little dysphagia heads and think of the body as a whole mechanism.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And if we don't, and we as speech pathologists have not studied muscles and, you know, and kinesiology, movement of right, muscles right. And the impact. So let's just say one more time between you and me. So watching meals is of no value. Okay. Right. Counting the right. number of times people cough or clear their throat or their nose runs or their eyes water or whatever you're counting or whatever you're watching, it's not right. helping your patient get better. And you're not learning anything about your patient.
Well, that's all I've been doing for the last 10 years, Ed. So what do you propose that I start doing now?
Well, I propose that you actually assess something and try to rehabilitate it. You know, okay. So, yeah, find out if the tongue is actually weak and then maybe do some rehabilitative activities. Find out, you know, what the pathophysiology is of those 17 physiological processes that you just wrote your blog about, find out which right. one is breaking down. Well, actually I will say there's 15 because two of them are residue, which are the symptom of a physiological process breaking down, not actually a physiological process. So find out which of those 15 things isn't working and get your butt in the therapy room and work on that.
There you go.
Get out of the dining room, out of the dining room.
There you go. There you have it.
Because when I get old, I will spit my food on you if you watch me eat.
Right. I know. All right.
I already have a plan.
Yeah. Good. You should. We all should. SLPs that we do not want to treat us. Yeah. Don't get on my shit list.
Right. Well, and what I'm going to do when they come to me, you know, I mean, anyway, yeah. Forks will be a great weapon.
Right. All right. Well, I'm going to throw one last question at you, Ed, and I'm pretty sure this is a good segue because I know exactly what you're going to say and you're going to get me on a tangent about it. But what is one treatment strategy, paper, research article that has really changed your thinking about dysphagia?
In all honesty, you gave me a heads up on this. And so when my first reaction was that I have two. But, you know, so I have a goal for myself. My goal is that I read three articles every week. So,
oh my gosh.
You know, so I have a, so at the end of the year, I can say I've read about 160 articles, right?
Oh my gosh.
And this is, you know, and here's my philosophy on that. If you don't set a goal for yourself, you're never going to do anything. Right. And so,
yeah, absolutely.
So you have to set a goal to make yourself accountable for learning. And that's one of my goals. Anyway, so as I drove down the road today, thinking about it, I thought, I can't just say one. I really just can't say one. So I'm going to start in chronological order of the ones that have impacted me the most. Okay. And there's just three.
Oh, you're going to have three. Okay. All right.
Because if I read three a week, right, 160 a year or so, you know, I mean, come on, I have more than one.
It's a lot of brain explosions. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I could remember all of them. But anyway, I remember the ones that are important to me, right, or that change the way I think about something.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first one was published in 2007 by one of the kindest, nicest people that I've ever met, Lori Burkhead, now Lori Burkhead Morgan. And it was Strength Training Exercise and Dysphagia Rehabilitation Principles, Procedures, and Directions for Future Research. So this was really the first article that 100% addressed using exercise principles, exercise physiology principles, and applying them to dysphagia rehabilitation. So this was a big leap forward of get off the compensatory strategies and get into the rehabilitative strategies.
Get out of the dining room and get into the therapy gym.
There you go. So that was a big one for me, right? It was like, okay, so stop doing all this silly stuff that's not changing anything. And it talks about those muscles and some of the things we've talked about today. Okay. The second one is, was published in 2010 by, Giselle Carnaby and Mike Crary, and it's the McNeil Dysphagia Therapy Program. So it was a radical change for me thinking about swallowing is not just about strength. It's not, you know, it's a sensory motor event and everything is not about strength. And so if we could exercise your tongue until it looks like you have a six pack tongue, but if it doesn't have the coordination and motor planning that is required to swallow the bolus, then
you're
it's
just
never going to happen.
A dumb jock.
That's right. Your tongue is a dumb jock. That's right. And the other thing is that the system has to be flexible. We only get better at what we practice. You know, if I'm a piano player, if I only practice a B flat scale, I'm never going to get better at a C scale. So, you know, and I can't divulge a whole lot about this technique or whatever, but it's about making the system flexible and using the system to treat itself.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and it's not just separating all the components out. It's working on all the components simultaneously.
Yeah.
So no matter what I'm doing, even people that I teach that I can't teach about this technique, I teach them principles of making sure the patient's swallow is flexible, making sure it's adapted to all different kinds of conditions, not just one thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and maybe one day you'll be lucky enough to go to this course and it will change your life.
Right.
Too.
I mean, and that's my caveat with this course. So if you aren't familiar with it, you have to go to this course, and it's, you know, they only offer it in Florida. Like, I think they've traveled a couple times, but it's just a very limited.
Yeah, no, they've traveled.
There's only limited opportunities to take the course and they don't divulge anything about it, which is fine. But then everybody that's done it is saying that it's like life changing, and everybody that's done it says they have like the golden ticket to treat dysphagia. And if you can't take this course, you're screwed. And I think that's what makes me so angry is like the last time that it was offered, I had a conflict or something that weekend. So Teresa's screwed and doesn't get to take it this year, you know? So that's
okay.
Just my
because
beef with it. So this is like my public
priority.
Yeah. This is my public plea to Dr. Crary to just figure out a way it's really just because everyone says it's such an incredible course. And you're probably the 20th person in the last month that said that this training has changed the way they think about dysphagia. So I just want to know about the information and I can't get it. So.
Well, yeah, because we all sign a pledge that says we won't teach it to you.
Right. And I hate you all.
But I know that they have, yeah, well, what can I say? I hate me.
Right.
I know that they have plans to, you know, to publish some more information about this, that they're working on maybe a book, or, you know, they have several things in the works because they want to be able to disseminate this technique too, but they want to make sure that the program maintains its integrity.
Yeah. That's understandable.
And that's, you know, and that's their big thing. They want to make sure that, you know, if you use this program, that you use it right, so that you're not going around saying, yeah, I tried that and it doesn't work.
Right.
And not that it's, and they will even tell you it's not a panacea. It doesn't work for everyone. But if you use it right and you use the principles and apply the principles right, it really does make you think about this disorder in a very different way.
Yeah.
So there, everyone listening to this podcast now can put it on your bucket list to go to this course.
Yes.
And when I talk to them, I'm going down in October to be a part of Giselle's dysphagia course, so I can say. So everyone on this podcast is begging you to teach more of these courses.
Yes, please. For the love of me.
So, and the third article was published in 2013 by our friend Ian Nissa Humbert. And it was that the title of the article is New Directions for Understanding Neurocontrol and Swallowing the Potential and Promise of Motor Learning. So again, this was this leap, and, you know, and it's hard to believe that it wasn't figured out until 2013. So God bless her that she thought about this, that swallowing is just not all about strength, that there is this motor learning component that can also take place. And so it's a really cool article, and she used eSTEM to demonstrate this concept. And again, it just changed the whole way that I think about this disorder. And she and Emily, Dr. Plowman, have done this, you know, strength versus motor learning debate, like they did it at ASHA in a couple years ago. And it's just very interesting to hear there, you know, why people might think that it's strength, or why people might think that it's motor learning, but really swallowing is both, and we need to be working on both and not just thinking about it one way. So those are my three articles that really have changed kind of the way that I approach this disorder and the way that I think about this disorder.
You know, I think all three of those articles are great, and they all kind of have the same underlying effects of, we need to challenge the system. We need to overload the system if we want it to get better. We can't just sit and watch our patients eat.
Yes.
And expect the swallow to just magically get better. I mean, unless you have like the Ed Bice magic fairy pixie dust that you sprinkle on your patients and they get better. But
right.
None of us are lucky enough to have that. So we have to go back challenging the system.
Yeah. Well, maybe I got that at the McNeil course. I can't quite remember.
God!
but at any rate, yeah, you know, and I understand where we've come from. I understand that it is the history of our profession that we didn't know what to do. So we did all this compensatory stuff, and we watched people eat thinking that we were learning something. But that is so that is so archaic and so behind where we need to be now, that right. We just need to give it up and move forward.
I mean, I just try to always channel my inner Maya Angelou. And when we know better, we do better. So we have this information now. Don't just keep it stuffed in your textbooks. Like, we actually need to be using this.
Right. And if you know something that I'm doing that should be different or that's not right, I welcome that feedback. I hope I never get to the place in my life where I become defensive and own a particular method to the harm and detriment of my patients.
Right. So I think that's what's, you know, the whole title of this podcast is Swallow Your Pride. You know, just admit that we didn't know things, you know, like you said, even 10 years ago. I mean, that's like right when I got out of grad school, and the stuff I'm doing now is completely different. You know, admit that we know better. That's the whole point of science. That's the whole point of research That's what these researchers get funded to do, is to figure out how we can do things better. So,
and heaven knows they understand it much better than we do. So let's just listen to them.
Right.
You know, my first dysphagia course was in 1991, I believe, from Jerry Logeman herself.
Oh my gosh.
And so, but as I think back on that course, I can't think of anything that I do now that she taught me in that course.
Right. Well, I think that's what frustrates me so much about when I ask people what, you know, I just started this, the newbie Med SLP group on Facebook. And I have one of the questions, like, what's your go-to source for dysphagia? And the majority is still the 1998 Jerry Logaman textbook. And I get it, but there is so much, we've learned so much more since then. There's other textbooks out there now that, you know, explain things.
Well, and the problem with textbooks is it takes so long to write a textbook and to get it into publication. Yeah. By the time it's published, probably the things in it are no longer valid. So don't use textbooks as your go-to. I mean, use them as a resource. I'm not saying throw them out. Heavens, I still have my, you know, Jerry Logaman book and my Mike Grower book sitting on the shelf, and I'll refer to them for like anatomy kind of things, or neurology, you know, or neuroanatomy kind of things. But when it comes to treatment approaches, yeah, those are not my resources.
Right.
So, anatomy doesn't change. Right. But approaches do.
Right. There you go. There you go. Parting words from Ed Bice.
All right. There you go.
Well, thanks so much, Ed.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to do this.
Oh my gosh. I know. I could talk to you forever. You're obviously a research sponge. I guess if you read 160 articles a year, then you must, I guess, know something. So at least I hope, but yes, we know.
I know that I'm tired. I know that I'm fatigued at the end of reading all
of this. Right. There you go.
So if you would love to hear more of these episodes and get some easily digestible bites of swallowing knowledge, then please leave a review on iTunes or pledge a small amount on patreon.com/swallowyourpride, because that is what keeps these episodes coming. Also, don't forget to subscribe, share with your closest colleagues, and show notes will always be available to download over on swallowyourpridepodcast.com, where you can also be notified of the latest podcast episodes. Also, credit to Stephanie Jacobson for her incredible editing skills, and thank you so much to all of you for listening.